For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. House Floor Leader John Eccles is telling Republican representatives to report to the state capitol to resume the special session on Monday at 1 in the afternoon. He says a deal is getting released on a plan to fix the budget, but failed at the time to give specifics on the proposal. Now, as we are recording this, we still haven't received any specifics. But Neva, do you think that something is forthcoming?
Well, I think they're trying hard to get something forthcoming, and I think we'll just have to wait and see. We've had this start and stop now for weeks, and I think the Senate's basically their folks, as I understand it, are kind of on call that we'll give you 24 hours notice to be at the building if you need to be. Certainly on the House side, they've been working very hard to try to get some sort of plan that they can get a majority of the Republican caucus to go along with. So there seems to be some headway this week. We'll just have to see if it unravels. Next week is really kind of D week in my mind, because we've talked about they've got this artificial kind of deadline with the building closing for a week. So I think there is a hard push to see if they really can make this concerted effort and get something done. But there have been some other flies in the ointment that we can talk about as we progress.
Ryan.
Well, and let's not gloss over the fact that we have a Republican governor, Mary Fallon. And I've got some beef with her proposal, but let's give her some credit. Here's a Republican governor who has put forward a plan to the variety of players at the Capitol, in the House and the Senate, leadership in both parties, calling for tax increases, everything from an increase to the gross production tax, bring it up to 5%, it's lower than the historic rate of 7, increasing income taxes for the upper income earners in the state of Oklahoma. That's a huge deal to have the governor come in and say, we're going to do this, and this is part of a package that will go along with the cigarette tax. There's a lot to be debated in terms of the merits there, but I think that it's a real game changer in terms of the traditional or the conventional wisdom around Republicans and tax increases at the state capitol.
But here's the flip side of it. We had former United States Senator Tom Coburn, former Governor Frank Keating, former Secretary of State for Mary Fallon, Larry Parman, come out this week with a letter to not only the governor, lieutenant governor, and all lawmakers, saying basically kind of throwing out the Reagan mantle of this is a party that is about less government, not taxing the people, and really kind of laying down the gauntlet with these lawmakers that this is not a road to go down if you want to be successful within your own party. So we'll see. There's this real struggle of what these folks really want to do, not only short-term to deal with this shortfall, but long-term to deal with addressing philosophically how they're going to govern in the majority.
And I think what the governor would say to that is, hey, it's really easy to say that stuff from the sidelines, but we're dealing with a massive budget hole of $500 million. We're looking, each year it gets worse and worse, and she has to deal with in reality. And the reality is that the state doesn't have enough revenue to fund the services that the people expect it to fund. And so they can sit on the sidelines and throw rocks, but here's a governor saying, we have to have new revenue. It has to be recurring revenue. It can't be one-time monies.
And by the same token, I mean, the treasurer came out this week saying that that in September we took in $1 billion in the state, $72 million more than a year ago in September. So clearly that 7% increase shows that we are seeing a turnaround in the economy. It's not going to be overnight. It's not going to fix the immediate problems nor the long-term issues with the budget, but it does paint a much better picture than what we were talking about a year ago at this time.
Right, but that money was already anticipated. That was the money that was increased.
But it also shows, though, the trend, and even though some of that was anticipated, not all of it. I think there was at least $20 million in that figure for that month that was above and beyond the revenue projection. So I think at least what we see, and again, this folds into all of the debate about GPT and all of these other issues that are trying to be thrust onto the board. I mean, do you look at that as a viable option? I mean, if you're a lawmaker, when you're seeing not only the economy begin to improve, but certainly that sector of the economy being one of the big architects of folding more money into the budget.
And Coburn and Keating can have their say, but In political terms, they're, at least in terms of actually passing or signing a budget, they're irrelevant here. The folks that are relevant are having a very healthy conversation with one huge glaring exception, and that's Speaker Charles McCall, who has, I think, been the real roadblock to real compromise in the legislature. And so much so right now that I'm hearing rumors at the Capitol that there are questions within his own caucus as to whether or not he remains Speaker up to the legislative session that starts in 2018.
And I know we'll be talking more about this next week once we have some plans. The Oklahoma Supreme Court declares unconstitutional another section of the 2013 Workers' Compensation Overhaul Bill. Justices say the provision stopping benefits if a worker misses two or more medical appointments tips the balance too far in favor of employers. Attorneys say this is the 44th provision of the bill to be found unconstitutional since it took effect 3 years ago. Ryan, your thoughts on this latest ruling?
The court is upholding what the grand bargain of the workers' compensation system is. I mean, if we think back to the early part of the 20th century when Oklahoma adopted the workers' comp system, what the legislature did there was they said employees who are hurt at work, they no longer got to take their employers to district court and sue them the way that we sue everybody else. But in exchange, employers had to give up the right to defend themselves. They had to say, all right, well, if you're injured at work, that's the element here. If you're injured at work, we're going to have a system that makes sure that you're made as whole as possible. You're going to have a remedy. What these workers' compensation so-called reforms have been over the last decade plus have really been the result of lobbying efforts by big insurance company and big employers to try to reduce their liability and to upset that grand bargain. And the Supreme Court said that as much in their opinion. They said this upsets that delicate balance between the rights of employers and employees under the system. And just by missing a couple of doctor's appointments because you don't have transportation, that takes away a remedy that you're guaranteed under the Oklahoma Constitution.
Neva.
Well, I think converting from the judicial process to the administrative process within the workers' comp system, we've seen since 2014 a lot of changes. And clearly, as they have taken these provisions and as they have been litigated, I mean, we've seen things occur just like what you say, Michael, in terms of 44 provisions that have the court has said were not appropriate and found unconstitutional in terms of the language. So I think anytime you make a seismic shift in the operation of something like the workers' comp system, you're going to see these ongoing litigations and these ongoing changes that will result from it.
Right. It seems, I guess, good news for the people who created this that they haven't shot down the entire bill.
Absolutely.
They just kind of whittled away at parts and pieces that.
And when you have such a comprehensive overhaul, I mean, you are going to have in any system. I think this is to be expected. I don't think this is a surprise. I think it will be an ongoing rollout of these kind of questions, and the court will have to make their determinations.
EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is facing accusations of extra spending again. Last week, we talked about the former Oklahoma Attorney General spending $25,000 on a soundproof phone booth in his office. And shortly after that, the Oklahoman released a story showing he billed taxpayers nearly $15,000 to fly around Oklahoma in one day. Neva, Tom Price lost his job as Health and Human Services Secretary for flight costs. Should Pruitt be concerned?
Well, these are the questions that will have to be sorted out. And certainly, I think you have to look at a few things right up front. First of all, the EPA and their attorneys approved this travel plan and approved this expenditure. So one of the things in this particular issue with the Tulsa to Guymond, Oklahoma City trip that's been called into question now is the fact that there was no commercial aircraft, no flights from Guymond, you know, either direction. So I think, again, as I've said before, this is one of those things it has a lot of sizzle. It makes a good story. It makes something for people to kind of stop and listen and pay attention to. But we've had this going on from whichever administration's in, the folks that are out are going to, you know, kind of fire the salvos. I mean, we had Nancy Pelosi when she was Speaker of the House. I mean, $2.1 million in U.S. Air Force aircraft used week in and week out from D.C. to California to take her back to her home district and back and forth. And so we've seen this again with Republicans and Democrats. So I think it's as highly partisan charged. I think the bottom line in my mind is set the rules, make them follow the rules, and whatever administration and their folks are at the helm, they need to make sure that it's clear so that the public knows that it's not necessarily something that's being done illegal or wrong, but it's something that that they abide by and sanction, and then the voters, when they go to the polls, can make their decision accordingly.
Ryan.
The last EPA administrator under the Obama administration took one chartered flight, to my knowledge. And I don't think she ever used military aircraft. We've got Scott Pruitt here using military aircraft at a cost of $36,000 to get from Maryland to Ohio, from Ohio to New York in a single day. I challenge anybody who's talking about past administrations and cabinet posts to come up with figures that are as disappointing and upsetting as what we're seeing out of this current administration. We had the Health and Human Services Secretary resign over this very thing less than a week ago. And Scott Pruitt's, you know, we can talk about Nancy Pelosi, you know, she spent all that money, but she's in the line of secession. So whenever you've got somebody who's third in the line,
What about the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, who had $800,000 in these same sort of travel expenditures that were called into question when he was going back and forth between
California? The highest-ranking civilian member of the military,
California.
I think, is a little bit different than the EPA administrator. Going to Guymon.
Cabinet officials.
Going to Guymon to have a conversation and with some farmers. Send an administrator out there, and you can send him out there for a few hundred dollars. He refused, he billed the taxpayers $5,000 or nearly $6,000 to get from Denver to Durango because he had a seat on a plane that would have cost taxpayers nothing, but he couldn't bring his entourage with him. And so he, instead of going with Governor Hickenlooper and riding with the Democrat, going down to Durango for this meeting where he could have done the exact same thing,
but
he billed the taxpayers
$6,000. I think the question is the public going to micromanage the administrative day-to-day travel log and duties of these particular folks, or are they going to establish rules and set the parameters and let these folks do their work? And, if you want to put the politics, inject the politics into it, that's always going to be there, whether it's Republican or Democrat, line of succession or not. The bottom line is this is more about just folks trying to take a piece of someone they don't like and give them some bad press than it is really addressing the issue at hand, and that's the thing that kind of gets lost in the mix on this whole conversation.
Well, I think also there's the fact that he took a chartered flight or took a flight from Tulsa to Guymon. He could have gotten an Uber, and I mean, it's not like Guymon to Tulsa.
He could have had Uber at
far.
Surge rate, and it would have cost less.
I mean, it's just across the state. I've driven from Tulsa to Guymon. It doesn't take that long.
And I guess we could say that about anyone. I mean, starting from the highest ranking officials in the government, any more than what are we going to say that the next governor of the state of Oklahoma who has a plane at their disposal. I mean, it's okay to go from this point to this point if this is what you're doing, but if it's something else and we don't like it, then we're going to take exception with it. I think it goes to the core philosophy of an administration at any level, state or national, and then the people will judge based upon how they think these taxpayer dollars are being spent.
Oklahoma Senator James Lankford joins two fellow Republicans in crafting a measure to help those affected by the cancellation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The SUCCEED Act allows undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. before the age of 16 and prior to June 15th of 2012 to obtain conditional permanent status if they meet certain requirements. Ryan, your thoughts on this legislation?
Well, it's one of at least two other pieces of legislation that are making its way through the United States Congress right now in dealing with President Trump's repeal of the Deferred Action Program, kind of forcing the hand of Congress to do something about this. I think that the public outcry that resulted whenever President Trump in a very desensitized way, said that all of these folks were going to be eligible for deportation. He was going to upset families and communities in a way that most Americans across the political divide said was unnecessary and unwarranted. We were punishing folks that ought not be punished. And so we've seen Republicans and Democrats in Congress step up to the plate here. I think that Senator Lankford's bill, of the three that I've looked at, is the weakest of the three. But I think that we can at least commend him for trying to find a solution here. That's in stark contrast to his fellow Oklahoma Senator, Senator Jim Inhofe, who this week said, this is his disposition on immigration. He said that the shooting in Las Vegas was a result of a permissive culture that is embodied by these sanctuary cities, that if we have sanctuary cities like Las Vegas, then what we're essentially saying is that we're not going to enforce the law, and that creates this culture of permissiveness and lawlessness. That's just ridiculous and absurd and insulting both to the tragedy in Las Vegas and to the the necessary debate around immigration.
Neva, I saw an interesting cartoon in the Tulsa World this Thursday morning where it showed Lankford basically talking about this SUCCEED Act and to a bunch of Republicans who did not seem too happy about what he's talking
well,
about.
Well, and again, I think what we have in Senator Lankford and this proposal, which is not a standalone proposal, this is part of an overall comprehensive dialogue about immigration reform. And I think even this week on Tuesday in the Senate Judiciary Committee, we saw that that there was a lot of sentiment toward at least giving this a very fair review. And many of these points, I think, finally becoming part of the overall rehaul and change that's going to come about. And I think you're right, Michael. I mean, it's time to put up or shut up. This is one of these issues that's been there. And now I think there is some resolve in the United States Senate to address it. And it will be a situation where there will have to be a lot of give and take. Certainly, even from what Senator Lankford has said, at least the concept of the proposal that's on the table that he and a couple of other senators have put forward at least has been looked at by the White House and given at least an initial nod of approval to have some level of support, which is important in the process. So I applaud the effort and hope that we don't, as I think Lindsey Graham said during that hearing on Tuesday, I mean, he said, how would you like to be these folks that are being impacted by this and see your future hang in the balance by, this small group in Congress that are going to be charged with making the final decision? So I think everyone's kind of up the ante at the table, and hopefully we'll see some results.
Yeah, I mean, there's real tangible fear in the immigrant community in Oklahoma and across the country, and they are depending on something to happen in Congress right now because, frankly, the tone is more reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, I think just like this, just like what we're seeing in the dialogue from Senator Lankford and others, I mean, we're seeing an attempt to have a reasonable civil discourse on this and try to find something that will not make everyone necessarily happen, but deal with the issues. I mean, not only the border security and all of these other immigration reform measures that are going to be part of the total, the total look and total package, but deal with the impact on these folks, many of whom it was not their decision. I mean, many of whom need to be their futures need to be taken into account very seriously and the right thing hopefully done.
And there's also a cry out from the economic community as well, yeah, because these young people who are now not really young people, they're teachers.
They're already in the economy, and that was one of the points that Senator Lankford made, is that, I mean, this notion that somehow this is going to adversely affect the economy, these folks are already contributing to the economy in a very significant way.
And just a few years ago, I think Senator Inhofe's commentary about sanctuary cities and demonizing immigrants and the immigrant community in America, that would have been much more of a mainstream way of thinking about immigration and immigration reform in Congress. And I think that there is still a sizable and a troublingly large element within Congress that holds that view, but I think they're becoming more and more marginalized by people, regardless of where they previously stood on this issue, realizing that there has to be a solution here, and if there's not, we're going to destroy a lot of people's lives.
Well, and I think we also have a situation where the extremes on both sides, I mean, you have groups like Breitbart on the far right, and you have the Fair Immigration Reform Movement would be on the other end of the spectrum. I mean, these folks, I mean, have these intractable positions that are never going to get a majority sentiment, either, I think, in the United States Congress or among the American people now today. But if we can move it to the middle and find something that will indeed address the problems, I think we'll have gone a long way.
A state lawmaker who has been mentioned several times on our show for his opposition to corrections reform failed to mention thousands of dollars in donations to his campaign. Chickasha Republican Representative Scott Biggs filed a correction report to reflect more than $10,000 donated to his 2014 reelection campaign. Neva, Biggs says this was just mistakes and reporting errors, which he has fixed.
Well, and at this point, I mean, we have to take that at face value. I mean, at least when you look at what goes on with these Ethics Commission reports and filings, it is clear that the Ethics Commission, much like the FEC at the federal level, is taking a much more aggressive posture in looking at these reports and analyzing them and matching them up. If a PAC says that they gave $5,000 to Representative X, and in Representative X's filing during that same period, there is no $5,000 from this PAC. We have a dispute and an issue that needs to be looked at. The other thing that's infused into the whole process is anyone can go make a complaint or make an allegation. These are not acknowledged, either that they're happening or not happening, by the Ethics Commission, as Ashley Kemp, the executive director, said this week with respect to this issue with Representative Biggs. And so I think we're going to have a lot of this that goes on. We've already seen it with some of the lawmakers that have been in trouble, and then they start looking at ethics reports on top of it and their filings. And bottom line is, there are rules, they're serious, they're to be adhered to, and I think anyone running for office for the first time or anyone serving now in public office need to be very diligent in making sure that even if you say someone else is being tasked with the duty of getting the report done and in on time, you better make sure that that in fact happens and you know what's in it.
Ryan.
Well, let's think about who Scott Biggs is for a moment. Here's a guy who in the legislature, his entire legislative agenda around criminal justice issues is built around the idea that we have to preserve the status quo. We have to keep the current criminal penalties in place, and in many instances, make them more severe. And his rationale for that is that any sort of leniency, any sort of looking at the context and trying to impose or inject some humanity into the system, that leniency encourages criminal activity. That we have to be hard on people. We've got to throw the book at them. We got to be severe, except whenever it comes to him. He's saying now, I've made a mistake. I tried to make it right, and please be lenient on me. Well, that's the very definition of restorative justice. That's what groups like the ACLU, former Speaker Chris Steele, other folks have been working towards, and that Scott Biggs has been trying to prevent from occurring in the state of Oklahoma by doing everything from trying to upend the people's will by repealing State Question 780, this massive criminal justice reform that was passed by the people of Oklahoma, by nearly 60% of Oklahomans. He's tried to repeal that within months of it passing. He's pushed for more severe and stiff penalties in the legislature. And he's stood in the way of Governor Mary Fallon's criminal justice reform measures in the legislature, single-handedly holding them up with with the enabling factor of Speaker Charles McCall. But now, he wants leniency. He wants people to look at the context. He wants people to acknowledge that mistakes happen, and that just because you've made a mistake doesn't mean you're a bad person. I'm not going to sit here and say that we should throw the book at him, but I do hope that Representative Biggs takes a long, hard look in the mirror and realizes that these two positions can't be reconciled, and the word for that is hypocrisy.
Well, I know you've got to give it up also to the Ethics Commission, who would only been around for about 25 years, and every year they always say cut more money from it. So the fact that they're out there doing their job, they're doing a lot more with a lot less. They're actually holding a lot of lawmakers' feet to the fire, both on the right and the left.
Yeah, well, and I think that, former Commissioner Lee Slater, whenever he took over that post several years ago, he's since left. But whenever he took over, he said he wanted to create a culture of compliance and not punishment. And I think that that's really what it is. I mean, the people of Oklahoma look to the Ethics Commission to provide a level of transparency, and so that we can look at our government officials and have a sense of what potential either contribution incentives or financial incentives they may have, and how that may be impacting the way that they operate in office. And just punishing people and prosecuting them doesn't necessarily get us to that transparency. That's the real intent of the Ethics Commission. So yeah, they're doing a lot with very few resources.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.